1. Welcome, Eagles, to another episode of Tradcat Night Radio. I'm Eric Ajewski, founder and owner of Tradcat Night, the most viewed and followed traditional Catholic website worldwide, ranked number one in the world as it relates to traditional Catholicism by Alexa, now a top 25,000 website in the world. Ladies and gentlemen, I can't thank you enough for all your prayers and support. We're getting our information out there to more of the mainstream, and I surely appreciate that. And today, I have with me another special guest. Now, I was recently on his show. It was about a month or two ago, and we kind of went through all the current events, and essentially that's what we're going to do today. So many of you already know who he is, but for those who do not, I have with me today Josh Tolley, who is a nationally syndicated talk show host with listeners in all 50 states and 160 countries. He's a three-time best-selling author, two-time Amazon number one best-selling author. I'm sure we'll talk about his book, Evangelpreneur, here in a little bit, which has been required for business students at some of the top Christian universities here in America. Josh has been seen on CBS, NBC, TBN, Al Jazeera, just to name a few. He was also the national television anchor for the 2012 presidential debate moderated by Larry King. Again, as mentioned, a successful entrepreneur and business coach for over 20 years. And like I said, hopefully we'll get into that in a little bit. But the big topic today, obviously, Josh, is the election. So just tell us what you were seeing, you know, maybe leading up to the elections. I think most of us were surprised by the outcome. And then, you know, when I go on radio shows, I said, you know, if Trump was to get in, I expected an immediate backlash. Like, this would just only propagate civil unrest in this country. And sure enough, within, you know, 24 hours, that's what we're seeing. So why don't you just break it down for us and what you're seeing on your end?
Oh, Eric, thank you so much for having me first. It's an honor to be with you today. And yeah, you're right. I mean, a lot of us who saw the support that Trump had, that's where the, I think, the disillusion between the American people and the American media really started in this election cycle. Because people saw tens of thousands of people showing up for Donald Trump, and Hillary was canceling campaign events because they couldn't get 50 people in a room. And it was at that point people started to say, hey, wait a second, this might actually happen, even though poll after poll after poll said there is no way. So there was almost this feeling that if he was going to win, they were going to somehow rig it so he actually lost. And it appears as if that's what they tried. I mean, evidence now coming out of New Mexico, Texas, Pennsylvania, Iowa, Illinois, of voting machines that were registering votes for Hillary, even though the vote went to Trump. That happened. The fact now that we know 3 million illegal aliens were voting in this election makes it so we can't even make the argument that she actually won the popular vote either. So she lost across all categories, all spectrums. He did better with women, blacks, and Hispanics than they thought he was going to. So here we are, and like you said, it's interesting how the Hillary campaign was urging Donald Trump to accept blindly whatever was to come in the election cycle. Of course, they knowing, wink, wink, that they were going to rig it to win. But now Donald Trump won, and they're trying to push back against the system with a signing of this pledge to get the Electoral College to vote according to their conscience. And of course, with the riots that we're seeing across the country, fueled and funded by the DNC and George Soros. So, yeah, here we are.
So in terms of Trump, let's break this down a little bit further. I mean, with us, Josh, it's kind of a mixed bag. There are some who think, you know, basically he's in on the game too. The mainstream media might just be pumping him up a little bit. Then the second thought is basically, well, he's a lesser of two evils. You know, he's pro-life. Let's go that route. And then third is, I lost my train of thought there. But that, you know, essentially that he is the real deal. I'm sorry. That he is the real deal. He is who he says he is. You know, let's talk a little bit more about Trump. I can honestly tell you this, Josh, was really sad when one of the polls came out. It indicated that 50% of all people who claimed to be Catholic voted for Clinton. And I went and I wrote a piece for Veterans Today. Yes, nearly 50% of people who call themselves Catholics voted for Clinton. I went on a tirade. I did a video. I mean, this shows you the signs of the times that we live in. How can any? And by the way, Josh, if you vote for a pro-abort in the Catholic Church, you are automatically excommunicated and you're denied communion. You don't. I mean, you're not even. I mean, there's a process that you would have to go through to even get back in the Catholic Church. So how this is being allowed is just beyond me. It just goes to show you who's actually running the Vatican at this point, as I mentioned on your show. But yeah. You know, talk to us a little bit more about Trump. I mean, what can we expect this upcoming year?
Okay, so here's the deal. A lot of people thought that he was just a stooge in order to get Hillary to win. Obviously, that didn't happen. Then a lot of people are saying, well, he's just a plant of the Republican Party. The situation as it seems to be is he believes the things that he has been saying. Now, is he always consistent? No, not always. The reality is, and I've been telling my listeners this for a long time, regardless of who would have won this election, the government's going to get bigger, period. Both of them are big government people. One just happens to be a big government globalist, and the other one is a big government nationalist. But the reality is that the police state, the surveillance, all that sort of stuff is getting bigger. It's not getting smaller. So welcome to the new reality. Now, with some of the appointments that he's making, Ryan Priebus as chief of staff, for example, Mitt Romney's niece as a high prominent party player, all that sort of stuff is making people say, hey, wait a second, I thought you were anti-establishment. What's up with appointing all the establishment people? And he's either A, going back on his word, or B, he's a genius and he's doing the proverbial keep your friends close but keep your enemies closer. So all of this is yet to be seen, though, because he hasn't been inaugurated. What I will predict, however, is I will predict that within 8 months of his presidency, we have some form of terrorist act in this country of large scale, of note. Because the globalists are now going to have to push back against this nationalist fight. And we're seeing the same thing right now in the UK. The UK, there's a leaked memorandum that is saying that there's really no intention for them to go through with the Brexit, that they're going to delay this thing as long as possible, regardless of how the people voted. And I think American people need to realize the same thing. Trump is one man in a system that was set up to be run by multiple different, not only branches of the government, but now dozens and dozens of agencies. So to think that one man can root out all the rats that have corrupted this thing in 4 years is a little folly. I mean, it's not going to happen. The opposite is going to happen, where we're going to have a lot of pushback from that globalist system. Because really, this is just the first swing that the people have taken. The people, ever since 1963 and the execution of JFK, the Democrat Party has been corrupted by a bunch of communists, globalists, and the Republicans have to a large extent too. And for all those years, we've been playing lesser of two evil politics. Yeah. Well, Donald Trump represents the people saying, no, we're just going to take a bat to this thing. But we need to realize that this is the first swing we've ever taken. The enemy's not just going to bow out and go home. And we're starting to see that even with the youth. The fact that these teachers are allowing students to have blankets and cookies and colleges are having puppy breaks. We think this is kind of funny, maybe nauseating. But in reality, what it's doing is it's firming up their communist sort of mindset, emotional driven base. That is the next generation of voting. If you look at the voting map and you took everybody 30 and under, there were only two states that went red. Two. So the future is not all sunshine and rainbows just because we have one man that is the opposite of Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, I would say that's probably the best way to describe it. Cautiously optimistic. I always say pray for the best, prepare for the worst. Again, we'll just have to wait and see how things develop. I will mention this. It came out the other day that Trump says he will uphold the law of the land in terms of same-sex marriage. So a lot of Republicans got ticked off at that. Again, we'll just have to see how things develop. But yeah, I agree with you too. I believe there's going to be a false flag in 2017. But I wanted to ask you specifically about the whole immigration crisis. You know, we've been bombarded by this term multiculturalism. You know, how realistic is it that Trump can slow down this process of quote-unquote refugees coming into this country? I mean, I think many of us see that as a Trojan horse. Eventually, there'll be some sort of false flag where, you know, Islam will be blamed, and ultimately that will probably drag us into a major war.
Well, yeah, I mean, here's the thing with Islam. There's false flags and real flags, but the reality is it doesn't really matter at the time that the flag is going up. You know, in my past, I was in the high-risk security industry, let's just say that. And if there was a situation or a conflict, yes, it's important to understand who's behind it, but that doesn't negate the fact that the conflict is real.
Right.
There's a lot of people who are saying, oh, well, you know, it's just false flags, as if somehow that makes the bullet softer. It doesn't matter who's going to shoot you. They're going to shoot you. So we have to kind of take this as a large macro view before we get to who's behind it. Because the reality is that Islam makes a great straw man for two reasons. One, you can pretty much pin anything on them and they're willing to accept it. Two, it's easy to hide the details in the minutia. Three, there's already a fire there. See, we've been fighting radical Islam since before this country was even founded. The British used to pay them off to leave their ships alone on their way to the new colonies. So radical Islam is a thing, and it's been real for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. And what the globalists have now done is they've just thrown a bunch of gasoline on an already existing fire. So yes, the globalists are to blame, but at the same time, that fire was there in the first place. And that threat is going to continue to exist as long as the other side of the supply chain is open. If Donald says, okay, well, we're going to shut down refugees, all that does is it's like putting your finger in a stream. It just means the water's going to go around a different direction, but the water's still going to come.
Yeah, and I agree with you, too. You know, differentiate between false flag and actual hoax. I mean, when the next 9/11 event does happen, I mean, it's really going to happen. It's not going to be like it's made up. There was Guccifer who came out, that guy that was thrown in jail, I think it was for 4 years, for exposing not only our government, but Clinton specifically came out and said that there were two attacks planned by our own government on the city of Chicago and one city in Pennsylvania. Obviously, that hasn't transpired yet. We'll wait to see. My next question for you, Josh, is this. How, with the election of Trump, how does that change things geopolitically with Russia, if any? We now see kind of a coalition being formed, it seems, between Putin and Trump over the issue of ISIS and the war on terror. However, I will interject that it has been reported in some news sites that Putin may even bail out. I'm not sure if you saw that. It's been circulating on some alternative news sites. Not sure how credible it is, but he's been saying he might resign this upcoming year.
I wouldn't see that as credible. I would have to hear him say it, because Putin has done something that has kind of set him up to be emperor of Russia. They recently changed the rules so that the term limits can be extended to him and him alone. He has run billions and billions of dollars through shadow corporations inside Russia. He's got palaces under other alternative names. He is doing, well, what Russian emperors do. So I don't think we're going to see him go anywhere. Even if he has to take a momentary step backwards like he did when he was president the first time, then he became prime minister and put Medvedev in president. Everybody knew you were really dealing with Putin. That was just a puppet. So I don't know. But beyond that, in dealing with Trump in the Middle East and ISIS, Russia's after strategic advantage just like we are. This whole idea that somehow Russia is holy Russia and somehow Russia is the crusader for the Christian values of the world is just nonsense. This is the same guy that is jailing Baptist missionaries and evangelists, because it's not about religious freedom. He knows he can use Russian Orthodoxy as a rallying call. And whenever a dictator takes over a country, you need three things. You need the religious foundation, you need a common enemy to fight, and you need the media. Well, that's exactly what Putin's going after. If you look at all of his actions, he's going after the military, saying, hey, we're in escalating global tension, so unite behind me. This is the same guy before the war rhetoric. If you remember, Moscow was having tens of thousands of people march down the streets to try to get rid of him. But now that there's a global common enemy, oh, Russia loves it. Same thing happened here with Bush. Bush had a 91% approval rating after 9/11 because, oh my gosh, we have a common enemy. So he's got that. He's got the media, because if you don't agree with him, he locks you up. So that's there. And now he's working on the economic side of this thing, too. So, no, I wouldn't trust Putin any further than I could throw him. But he is a genius. He's way outplaying Obama and Kerry. He's making them look like foolish children. He's good at what he does. He's just not good in what he does.
Yeah, it's kind of a mixed bag on that issue, too. You know, I would say many see him as, you know, still being KGB, even a crypto Jew. There's some evidence to suggest that. You know, I brought up on your show the whole message of Fatima that, you know, our Blessed Virgin Mary warned it in 1917 that Russia would spread her errors, but that ultimately Russia would be used to chastise the world, and Our Lady said various nations would be annihilated. So I think we're on the verge of that. But ultimately through that, she did mention that Russia would be instrumental into getting Christendom back. So I think at some point beyond Putin, there will be a change in that country. But I agree with you. It seems like we can't really trust any of our world leaders.
I'm not saying that Russia is not going to play an instrument in that. But if it's Russia playing an instrument in that, it's going to be the Russian people. It's kind of like throughout most of history, when God moves, he moves through the ordinary people who you don't suspect. The Bible is full of ordinary people, not people who place themselves as rulers, but as people who unsuspectedly just became rulers, like David. And, you know, it's just, so yeah, something might come through Russia, absolutely, but I don't think it's going to come through Putin. I think what Putin's doing, because God is so cool with what he does, I think Putin is using religion to manipulate the people and to get everybody unified. But what he doesn't realize is God is real. So you're going to unify people behind a real God, pretend it's your tool, but God's going to have a different purpose for it and kind of tip his hat and say, thank you. You know, what the devil intends for evil, God will use for good.
Yeah, and there's definitely a connection there between the KGB and the Russian Orthodox. There's no question about that.
Yeah.
My next question for you, kind of backtracking here a little bit along the lines of the elections. I know you've been reporting on this as well. You see all these liberal celebrities coming out now saying they're leaving the country who are now backtracking on that. They're not leaving the country. What are we to make of this madness? We also just had a report. Canada is now inviting four states to secede from the United States. As you're talking, I'll try to pull up actually which ones. I think they were more on the West Coast. I think Oregon was one of them.
But yeah, Oregon, Washington, California, and I think Idaho.
Yeah, there you go. And so, you know, it's just, you know, I say we live in a giant Jerry Springer world, and we're just kind of living in it. Forget about watching. I mean, we're actually living in it. What are we to make of all this madness?
Well, yeah, I mean, these celebrities aren't leaving. I mean, this happens all the time. It happened with George Bush as well. Oh, if George Bush is elected, we're leaving. Well, nobody left. That was just before Twitter and Facebook were huge, so there wasn't as much social buzz about it, but it happens all the time. They're not leaving. They're not going anywhere. America's their money pot, and to be honest, they're going to make more money ripping on the current president than they did under the president that they worshipped anyway. So now they're going to have their legions of fans buying more show tickets, buying more books. So it's good for their business, to be honest. They're not going anywhere.
Now, in terms of freedom, I know you're a big freedom guy, too. Let's talk with the election of Trump. What does it mean for the Second Amendment? Is it possible that somewhere, you know, along the lines that the liberals still gain some kind of control? I mean, there's some suggestion that Clinton will even come in after Trump. I mean, who knows? I mean, that's way down the road. And then again, like you said, I mean, who knows if Trump even gets in? There's some suggestion that, you know, they might try to prevent him from getting in, whether it's, you know, I hate to say the word assassination, but, you know, you just never know these days. But in terms of Second Amendment and then also censorship, we see a rise in censorship. I think I was on your show and relayed how I cannot even post my own articles on Twitter anymore. I'm now deemed a malicious site. So more of attack on conservative America, I guess we can say. What are the prospects like, you know, under Trump 2017 going forward?
Well, I think that as soon as the FBI admitted that Hillary Clinton committed all these crimes, which they did in July, and they just decided not to prosecute her, I think if I was Trump at that point, I would add another ring of security beside the Secret Service because the government system has been compromised. That alone would have sent a chill down my back to say, okay, here's supposed to be the rule of law, you're supposed to be the lead law enforcement agency, and they're corrupt, they're compromised. So, yeah, I would definitely be leery of Trump and his health. I've asked former Secret Service agents that. I've asked former Clinton employees that. And they've all said, yeah, I would be very cautious if I was Trump. Definitely make sure the food tester tastes the meal first. But as far as Second Amendment issues and censorship, let's deal with censorship first. As a freedom lover, I am appalled by how Twitter, Facebook, YouTube uses their platform to squash voices that they don't like. They've all been proven to do that. We've all had experience with it. But here's the other thing. It is private property.
Sure.
Twitter's private property, Facebook's private property, YouTube is private property. And I use them all, and I make money on them, and I hope they continue. But at the end of the day, it's private property. It is not the public square. And I think too many of us have been relying on internet websites as public square, First Amendment issue, rock, roar, instead of actually going out to do the work. And we've been hoping that all we have to do is post a meme or put out a tweet and freedom will rise its head, not realizing that we're playing on their private property and they can shut it down whenever they want. I think we need to get back to real public demonstrations, real newspapers, our own version of websites. That stuff has gone away because the freedom-loving, Second Amendment-loving, conspiracy theorists, whatever sort of crowds, they all want to use existing platforms so they don't have to go out and do it themselves.
And, yeah, there's another report. I'm just reading it right now. Zuckerberg vows to weed out quote-unquote fake news from Facebook. I know they've also, yeah, there's just a lot of stories like that. That one just came out today. I'm just reading it now.
It's terrible. I don't like that they do it. I think it's terrible. I've posted videos on YouTube, and because I went after Hillary, they're like, oh, your video is not subject for monetization. And as people who make money on YouTube know, that could be a lot of money. But they do it just because I took on Hillary. There was nothing copyrighted in that. So I hate that they do it. But at the same time, as somebody who loves freedom, it's their property. Google owns YouTube. They should have the ability to do whatever they want to with it. If I own JoshTube and somebody put up there, hey, we hate all redheads, of course I want the ability to say, well, you're gone. But so that's the paradox we're in. We have to get to this point where our side once again uses free enterprise to build a system that distributes information, that promotes entrepreneurship, that rebuilds family, that rebuilds churches, and takes back territory lost. And instead, all we seem to do is, well, we voted. But other than that, all we seem to do is post messages on social media about it.
Now, Josh, where are we economically from your standpoint? You know, I've had on some of the top trendsetters, you know, Gerald Celente, all the top economists, Bo Polny, Rob Kirby, just to name a few, Greg Mannarino. And, you know, they're all suggesting by year's end 2016, with the exception of one, V, the Gorilla Economist, said he thinks somewhere in 2017. You know, I said that they would use Trump as the scapegoat for this, or a scapegoat for this, and then revolution would really kick up. I mean, you think it's bad now. I mean, just wait till after, you know, an economic collapse and just see how the major cities are doing. But, you know, where are we at economically? Is it, you know, is it a propped up Ponzi scheme that's just waiting to fall, a house of cards, if you will?
Yep. that's the easy answer. Yeah, it is. Because here's the reality. We have two things that are working against us. We have the fiat currency and fractionary lending, and then we also have employment-based economies. And the reason we have the fiat currency central bank system is because of the employment-based economies. No employment-based model can last longer than three generations. It's impossible. Whatever inflationary model is involved will then eat up the base. And that's exactly what we've experienced. Three generations ago, we had the New Deal. That was the first time we switched the scales to an employment-based economy. Well, here we are three generations. And the first generation, it worked fine. These were the people who had, you know, well, dad worked for the factory for 40 years, retired, and had a second home in Florida. Well, then the second generation came along, and it didn't quite work out as well. Halfway through the second generation's productive years was the 80s. Now, these are the baby boomers. So halfway through their productive years, they realized that inflation is going to kill them. So they came up with what was called reverse mortgages, because most people's number one wealth asset is their home. So they had to figure out a way to cushion the impact of inflation. Well, now you're in the third generation of an employment-based economy, the 40 and unders, and we're all up a creek. They're telling us, well, statistically, if you're 40 and under, your number one place of death is going to be your job. People are working more hours if they do have a job. Job turnover, the average career lasts 4.5 years now. So the economy is getting worse and worse and worse. And unfortunately, all the sides, Libertarian, Republican, Democrat, Green, Conservative, they're all saying, which side can provide more jobs? And the reality is, if that's the answer, we will always be dead. It's always going to be a bad system. The only way to fix it is to increase entrepreneurship. The only way to get back to a standard of money that means anything is entrepreneurship. The only way to get rid of fractionary lending is entrepreneurship. The only way we stopped the central bank the first two times it started in this country was entrepreneurship. And then 1903 happens, we have the Industrial Revolution, 1913 comes along, we have people with massive big factories. We're not employment-based yet, but we're definitely going that way. Well, an employment-based economy needs an outside party to regulate the inflation. So when they come along the third time with the Federal Reserve, of course it makes sense and nobody pushes back. Yes, they did it in a secret vote and planned it on Jekyll Island, but nobody pushed back because employees do need something to help them with inflation. Inflation has been an effective rate of 10% every year since 1871, which means if your pension or your job does not give you a 10% raise every year, you are going backwards. So they have to manipulate the currency. They have to create bubbles. Otherwise, we'd all be dead already.
Once again, I have with me Josh Tolley. Please get to his website, joshtolley.com. You can also find him on Twitter and YouTube. Has a good YouTube page there as well. My next question for Josh, and I guess we'll stay along the same lines as it relates to business, is let's talk a little bit about your book, Evangelpreneur. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the book, give us a synopsis, where it can be bought, and then a kind of piggyback question to that, building off of that, is maybe give some practical advice from people who are starting up. They're just getting into whatever sector you want to choose. You know, you can just make a blanket statement general, but let's kind of hit those two areas if we can.
Okay. So Evangelpreneur was birthed out of being a man of faith who happens to be a businessman. I've been in business. I've been self-employed. I'm just celebrating my 21st year. So I started my first business 3 days after high school. And I've been up and down, you know, some have been successful, some have not. But over the course of time, I got more and more successful. And as that happened, more and more people asked me to speak and teach other people. But I'm also a man of faith. So I've been invited to a lot of churches, Catholic, Baptist, Lutheran, Jewish, like across the spectrum, to speak on financial issues. Because right now, more believers will declare bankruptcy than graduate from college. 4 out of 5 believers are at or near poverty. 1 in 2 don't have $500. So there's an epidemic happening in the faith community when it comes to finances. We've been sold this idea that it's either A, some sort of weird prosperity gospel that we see on TV, you know, buy my $900 handkerchief and become a millionaire by Tuesday, or we've been taught that it's poverty, poverty's the way to go, poverty, poverty, poverty. And the reality is that that's not what the Bible says in either direction. It's actually something quite different. So I'm speaking at these churches, and I'll overhear prayer requests. And I remember I was at this one church where 10 people came up for prayer, and 9 out of the 10 prayers were financial. And I'm thinking, well, this is ridiculous. So I go to a number of faith-based bookstores, and the only thing I can find there is some sort of, you know, get out of debt program or some sort of how to tithe, but really nothing when it comes to making money, entrepreneurship, prosperity, and not some sort of prosperity gospel, just biblical model. And so that's where it started. And one of the big revelations in this book Well, there's two. The first one is that God does not want you employed, and I can prove it. The Bible tells us in Matthew that we cannot be a servant to God and money. Not that we shouldn't, that we can't. It's impossible. You cannot serve God and money at the same time. Well, then if that's the case, we need to look at what a servant actually is. What is a servant when it comes to a biblical standard? And God says that a servant, I mean, just think about this compared to your own life, folks. A servant is somebody who works for his master, and he starts his day when the master says so. Well, when do you go to work? A servant is somebody who goes home or calls it a day, can end his duties when the master says so. When do you get to leave your job? A servant is somebody who, if they earned enough money, they could buy their freedom. Today we call that retirement. If I earn enough money, honey, if I can save up enough, I can buy my freedom. We are servants to money in employment. And people tell me all the time, well, Josh, I'm not a servant to money. I don't have a lot of money. What servant ever had a lot? Part of the clue that you were a servant is because you didn't have any. But that's exactly what employment is. You don't control your life. Your boss does. How much you give to the church is not determined by you. It's determined by your boss. Where you live is not determined by you. It's determined by your boss. What you give your wife for your anniversary is not determined by you. It's determined by your boss. And how you serve God is not determined by you. It's determined by your boss. So when we read in Matthew, you cannot serve God and be a servant to money, we need to realize that if we are employed, that's exactly what we are doing. We are being a servant to money. And God tells us not to do that. But you look at other examples, especially ones that we see in the Old and New Testament, where they talk about laborers. Laborers are not employees. Those are what we would consider small business owners. And Jesus actually uses this as a parable, and he's talking about the people who are working the field, and then these other guys come up, and they negotiate a price to work the field, and the first workers are upset because these people are going to make just as much, even though they showed up late. And God uses this as a parable to teach, but it's also a parable in entrepreneurship. Because if I was a laborer, not a servant. If I was a laborer and I saw you work in a field, I could come up and say, hey, guess what? I can help you for X amount of money. And when the job was done, I got to go home. I wasn't enslaved to you. I didn't have to come back tomorrow at 7. And if I wanted to, I could travel and do it someplace else. I could expand my skill set, go down to the Galilee and maybe repair fishing nets for a living. So that's one huge message that comes out of Evangelion. And this is why priests and pastors around the country and rabbis have been loving this book, because it addresses, oh my gosh, we've actually been teaching our people to be servants to money, but we've been telling them that employment is somehow what God wanted them to do, and it's not true. The other thing that really shocks people out of Evangelion is what I call the practical poverty level. I took the 12 foundational expenses in life. Now, these are national averages, so where somebody lives, it might be higher or lower, but just national averages. And I took the 12 foundational expenses. So we have rent at $1,000, car insurance at $144, cell phone at $73. I wish. I haven't had a $73 cell phone bill since 95. Utilities, $264. Cable and internet, $100. Food, $332. Gas, $220. Car payment, $466, savings for retirement, $395, we're all doing that, right? College loan payment, $575, life insurance, $33, health insurance, $402, because remember, now that's a law. Nothing excessive on this list, nothing. And that list is $70,000. So in America today, you need to make $70,000 a year to be flat broke busted. And that's the problem. We have candidates, and we have parties, and we have liberty lovers, and we have, you know, all these people out there saying, oh, middle class, not realizing that $70,000 a year is still broke. I didn't put clothes on the list. I didn't put having a baby on the list. I didn't put a flat tire on the list. And it takes $70,000. Well, the average American household income is $15,000 below what it costs to be broke. And guess how much debt the average household in America has? $15,000. Why do you think that is? It's not coincidence. It's math. And that's the other shock that comes out of this book and why so many people love it.
Wow. So in terms of just some practical advice, I mean, just real brief, in terms of a startup, let's say like maybe even the internet. And again, I've been fortunate. I actually have a master's degree in business. I mean, never actually owned a business myself, but I used some of the skills and knowledge that I had from, you know, both the business world and then just obtaining that degree to be able to put together a very formidable website. I mean, so what can you offer just in general some practical advice for some startups? Go ahead.
Well, the first thing is don't do something you know or love. This is probably the biggest mistake. When I get hired by a company to come in and fix the problem, usually it stems from doing something they know or love. Because your grandma taught you one day, do something you love and you'll never work a day in your life. However, what that turns into is entrepreneurs who work 40, 50, 60 hours a week, they end up hating what they do, the business ends up owning them, their family never sees them, and then they say, see, entrepreneurship doesn't work. Well, don't do it that way. What you have to do is you have to back up. You have to go through what I call the meaning of life process. It's a three-step process that I teach. Matter of fact, for a while, it was free online. But I teach a three-step process that by the time you're done, you understand how much money you need to make, how much time you can spend making it. Well, that right there does 90% of the work for you when it comes to what business should I start. That has saved so many marriages, so many businesses, it's not even funny. But then besides that, you have to see opportunity, not just, I want to start a business making guns or whatever. You have to say, where's the opportunity? Because here's some lies that we've been told. We've been told that it takes money to make money. Lie. I have helped homeless people start businesses. I have helped single people start businesses. I have helped felons start businesses. Money, it does not take money to make money. The problem comes in there is when we say, well, I want to start a bed and breakfast. Well, that takes $400,000. Well, see, Josh, I told you it takes money to make money. No. Back up. I met a guy, and I think I put this example in the book, actually. I met a guy at a tractor pull. I'm kind of a redneck that way. I was at a tractor pull. It was a nationally televised one, so thousands of fans over 4 days. But a tractor pull's not downtown Chicago. It's out in the middle of a field someplace. You're out in the middle of nowhere. So this guy was selling lemonade, and he had this little hut that he made from scrap wood he got at Home Depot, and he was selling lemonade for $6 a lemonade, and it's one of those big, like, 32-ounce cups or whatever. And this guy has a line. I mean, I waited in like a 45-minute line because there's nowhere else to get lemonade, right? There's nowhere else to get anything. So by the time I get to the front of the line, I ask this cat, I'm like, okay, just be honest. How much does this $6 lemonade cost you? And he said, with the cup or without the cup? And it was at that point I knew the dude was making money. And I said, with the cup. And he said, about 35 cents. I'm like, oh my gosh, you make like $5.50 per lemonade. And he's like, yeah. And I said, how many do you sell? And he said by the end of the weekend, he might sell 7,000, 8,000 of them. I'm like, oh, you're going to make $35,000 this weekend? He says, yep, I do this 5 times a year, make about 170 grand, and that's it. I work 5 weekends a year. I take the rest of the year off because it's my mission to go serve God with the rest of the time. And see, that's a great example comparing that to what most people do. If you look at most people, when they say, I want to be an entrepreneur, and they think of something that they are going to do themselves, and they're going to do it Monday through Friday. Well, we get that mindset from employment and in school, because we've been taught that you go to school Monday through Friday, you graduate, you go get a job Monday through Friday. So when most people start a business, they do a business Monday through Friday, typically from 8 until 5, because that's what they grew up in. But that's where the least amount of money is made. So we have to step back and say, what am I trying to make? How much time am I trying to make it in? It takes the same amount of time to make $1 million as it does 50,000. So what am I going to do with the time that I've allocated for starting a business? And how is that going to play into it? And the reality is that there are business opportunities everywhere. I did a class down in Florida, and part of it's actually up on YouTube. I made a video out of it where I took the class out, And I said, okay, pretend you're homeless. We're just going to pull the car over, and we're going to start a business because we don't want to be out on the street tonight. Within 15 minutes, we had a profitable business. By the time we broke for lunch, we already made $35,000. By the time we called it a day, we started four businesses and got two party boats, all with no money. And it's all because there's opportunity everywhere. We're just not taught anymore how to recognize it. I have a textbook that I keep on my bookshelf from 1929. Now, keep in mind, this is the generation right before we went to employment-based economy. That seventh-grade textbook, chapter one in a seventh-grade math textbook, is setting up your business and paying your laborers. Chapter three is setting up supply chain. Chapter seven is calculating insurance and periphery costs. I could teach an entire MBA course out of a seventh-grade textbook. But today, textbooks are hundreds of pages of repetition, 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 repetition. So we just learn to regurgitate answers, including in a lot of our business programs. So that way, when students come out, they're looking for something that they can just replicate. And in reality, that's not where success lies. We have to get back to making business an art form. We have to get back to being entrepreneurs, not just small business owners.
Yeah, you bring up an interesting point, which I've kind of raised when I go on radio shows, whether it's been Caravan to Midnight, Dave Hodges, in terms of preparation. You know, there are many quote-unquote conspiratorial types who are now getting more off the grid, if you will. They kind of see this cashless society emerging, you know, Mark of the Beast technology, type of technology wherein, you know, obviously we know the New World Order wants us in the system eventually to keep us in the system. And so it raises that question about, you know, is there that trend, you know, going back to bartering? Will everything become more localized? But where are you at in terms of preparation? You know, I kind of will quote scripture on this. You know, Noah prepped even during his times. We have, Joseph from the Old Testament also knew of the seven-year famine, so he prepared a little bit. Now, I'm not suggesting to go out there and, buy, you know, build yourself an underground bunker and hide yourself from the world. But, I mean, would you argue that at this point in time it would be prudent to prep even with Trump in office now?
Well, a few things on that. One, and building a bunker and hiding in one spot is probably one of the worst ways to prep. You're just a sitting duck. In my past professions, I've actually had to do some of the stuff people are thinking they're prepping for. And one of the things you want to remain is mobile. You want to be able to move as threats continue to develop and evolve, because a threat doesn't stay localized. So if you're like, I'm going to stand right here on this mountain with my four kids and my 30-30, well, you're toast. I mean, you're just good as dead. I don't care how much ammo you got. Two, we have to realize that when you have to prep for multiple contingencies. You can't have one evacuation plan, one rendezvous point. Yeah, that's not how any of this works. I would say most of the people who I meet who are preppers have no clue how to really prep. They're just part of the prepping industry, where a bunch of these people are selling them stuff and making billions of dollars doing it. Most preppers have no idea how to prep. For example, one of the things that you need to do if you are prepping is you need to learn how to barter, and not barter with other preppers, not barter on Craigslist or at Goodwill or at a flea market, but I mean actually take something out of your car, walk up to a stranger, and convince that person that what you are wanting to get rid of is more valuable to them than what they already have. That is bartering. That's a skill set. That is entrepreneurship. If people ask me all the time, Josh, what are you stocking up on? Are you stocking up on bullets? Yeah, I have some of that. But I'm also stocking up on first aid kits, baby formula, women's hygiene products, diapers. Because if this system goes down, my stockpile of tampons is worth way more than your stockpile of ammo.
Yeah, fair point.
And yeah, so people are prepping for something without even realizing what they're prepping for. And here again, entrepreneurship comes into play. Because if we look at any civilization, at any point in history, the people who organize it, thrive, and survive are always the entrepreneurs. Even in cases like Joshua in the Bible, right? Here we got Joshua. He knows how to be a stone cutter, right? Well, anybody can just stomp on bricks. So the Egyptians would kill them a dime a dozen. But if you want your face on the side of this pillar, you better not kill the guy who knows how to put your face on the side of the pillar. And because of that, he was able to negotiate for himself his own house. So even in absolute captivity, entrepreneurship works. And people tell me all the time, well, Josh, you know, what if the system crashes and there's no money? So what? Entrepreneurship. There are people in prison. If you've ever been to prison, or some of you have been to prison, and there's always that one guy who can get you whatever it is you're looking for, whether it's a girl magazine, cigarettes, whatever. That means this guy is literally using entrepreneurship to thrive while he's living in an 8x8 steel cage. Don't tell me that it doesn't work on the real world. And then again, you have the example of the Hebrews who were led out of captivity, out of Egypt. Did God say to them, go and leave everything behind? No. He said, go, and when you go, don't just take everything you have. Loot this place. Take everything. Take the gold, the treasure. Just take it all. Because every society has to have free enterprise as its foundation. Free enterprise has always been and will always be the fuel for freedom. So those two messages can never be separate. When I go to these prepper conferences and they're like, oh, no, I don't want to hear about entrepreneurship, then you're not prepping for anything. You're prepping to die. All you're really becoming is the store where I'm about to pick up stuff once you're dead.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, too. I was flipping on the channel. It was actually late last night after I was done with work, and there was a show, a documentary on a jail cell where they literally just put your everyday person in there, kind of like a mole, to kind of spy on these other individuals to give feedback to the sheriff who was local there. And he would, you know, these individuals would see these people moving in and out of items, and they were just floored by how they could do this and get by with it. So, yeah, I understand exactly what you're saying. It's very interesting. Now, you mentioned another key word there during your last take, threat. Now, with Trump's election, geopolitically speaking, who becomes the biggest threat to the United States? I mean, should we keep our eye not only on Russia, but what about China? I think Trump is going to meet with their president here very soon. You know, is it North Korea? That nut job over there is always, you know, pointing missiles at us and doing knuckleheaded things. I mean, who becomes the biggest threat, or is it still Russia, you think?
Well, North Korea is that dog behind the fence. You know, when you were a kid, you always had that one house in your neighborhood where you tried to scurry past that house because of the mean dog. That's Kim Jong-un. And he's mean. He's always been mean. He's always going to be mean. So, yeah, he's pointing weapons at everybody. But the reality is that Russia and China, those threats are threats whether it's now or years from now. They're not going away. Because when they prep for war, they're prepping against us. I don't care how friendly we are with them tomorrow. I don't care if, you know, Putin's like, well, let's open more McDonald's in Moscow. Yay. It doesn't really matter. Because the need for war for those two countries is rapidly increasing. Rapidly. Because here's something that we don't recognize when it comes to why are these two countries kind of rattling the sabers anyway. Obviously, a weak America is part of the reason. We've had a very weak America with Obama and Hillary and John Kerry. These negotiations have been just laughable. So, as these third-party entities, I would, too, take advantage of whatever opportunity I could take advantage of. But besides this, Russia and China are both facing rapid population decline. Rapid. As a matter of fact, the whole world is. We are going to go from 7 billion people to 9 billion people down to 2 billion people while most of your listening audience is still alive. And it is the biggest threat to the world is not talking about. Even if you go on the World Health Organization and look up peak population, they're going to say the world population is going to peak at somewhere around 9 billion people. Well, that means it's not even replacing the 7 that are here, because that would mean we would peak at 14. And I do, and this is hard over radio, but I have a whole presentation about this. But anyway, to get to the Russia-China part, those two countries, they're facing it even at a faster clip. Russia right now will pay you to have children. They will give you the day off to go home and make a baby. They have contests where, you know, if a woman gives birth closest to this date, she wins a car or something. They had a Boys to Men tour last summer, as weird as funny as it sounds. They had a Boys to Men tour last summer that was paid for by the Russian government just to get people in the mood. At the same time, in China, you're seeing something similar. China, the inventors of the abacus, evidently didn't do any math. When two people only have one little person, you cut the population not in half, you cut it by two-thirds in one generation. But not only that, they aborted 40 million of the girl babies because the girls weren't honorable or something. So China has no possible way of even maintaining their military. And I remember I was doing a course at a military base, and I asked the commander of the base, like the guy, I said, sir, before I said anything about this stuff, I said, sir, if you knew that the force that you were in command of was going to be reduced by two-thirds within 15 years, what would you do? And he said, well, I'd pick up the phone and call the president, and I would say, Mr. President, you have 10 years to do whatever it is you think you're going to be doing. We're going to do something. We have to do it now. And that's exactly what we're seeing. If China and Russia are ever going to be a superpower, they have to do it now. We are looking at double-digit population losses in these countries. And it's not just them. Japan. Japan lost 1.5 million people in the past 4 years. That would be the equivalent of a meteor coming and taking out Toledo and Cleveland. Like, this is massive. This is why borders across the world are open. It has nothing to do with economics or need more workers, or it has nothing to do with that. The world right now is scrambling to pick up people, and they're trying to do it without us knowing it, because this is the exact equivalent of a meteor hurling its way towards Earth. We know it's coming. NASA says it's going to be here in 15 years, and it's going to wipe out two-thirds of the planet. Well, if we knew that was coming, there'd be panic. This is exactly why the countries are doing what they're doing. Blaming geopolitical issues, blaming economic issues, blaming war issues. And it's really none of those things. It's they're trying not to have the global panic that would ensue if people understood what I just explained on this show.
Yeah, I totally agree. There's no doubt there's something on the horizon. That kind of gets into my next topic of signs of the times. You know, we report here quite often the Earth changes. We just had yesterday the supermoon, which I think is the brightest supermoon or the largest supermoon that will occur over the next till 2034, I believe it is. We had that massive quake out there in New Zealand. They had like well over 60 quakes. I had people emailing me left and right that morning. Just all these signs, you know, mass animal deaths around the world, people not paying attention. Then I also wanted to add today in terms of the freedom topic that Josh was talking about. Over the past few days, court orders removal of the Ten Commandments monument in New Mexico. The 10th Circuit Court of Appeals upheld a lower court order to remove the Ten Commandments monument from the lawn of Bloomfield City Hall in New Mexico. Now, I say that to develop into my next point. What are you seeing, Josh, in terms of the overall just rise in paganism / you know, we could go into Satanism? It seems like, you know, those areas are picking up, if you will, rise in the demonic, I guess we can call it. And, you know, I don't know if you saw this too, Josh. You know, I'm almost embarrassed to say this as a Catholic. And again, I was on your show and I told you I believe Francis is an anti-pope. He's a Freemasonic infiltrator. Well, I don't know if you saw this, but he came out and said communists are literally the best Christians. That is a direct quote, Josh. I say it, I kid you not. That's literally what he said. And, you know, I did a piece on him today, and I just was as sarcastic as I could be. But where are we at in terms of that, you know, the rise in the demonic?
Oh, my gosh, it's everywhere. I mean, look what happened with the spirit cooking thing. Or more importantly, look at what didn't happen. Here you have this WikiLeaks chain suggesting that people in the Hillary camp, all the way up to the campaign manager, the number two guy, are involved in some sort of weird satanic ritual. And America doesn't flip out? I don't care what party you were part of. If this happened in the 70s, 60s, 40s, there's no way that Hillary would have still been on the ballot. So there's this general acceptance of, oh, well, okay, we can have weird cultic things. But I, you know, even beyond that, we're seeing a massive increase in meteors, massive increase in the size of earthquakes. The number of 6.0 earthquakes and above is the highest it's ever been since we invented the Richter scale. And we're also seeing a shift in spiritual dynamics. We're having a mass exodus. And I know you're a Catholic show, but I'm just going to group all Christianity in the stat. 3 million people a year leave a Christian-based faith. 3 million a year. We have 7,000 churches a year closing. We have record low tithes. So we are seeing this mass exodus. But at the same time, something else is happening. In the book of Hosea, or Hosea, however you pronounce it, it talks about how in the end days, people are going to return to God. They're going to return to his name. They're going to return to his appointed times and seasons. And we're seeing that too. The people who are staying are becoming more devout. You know, we saw this rise in the 80s and 90s of the fake church in all denominations, to be honest, including Catholicism. There was just a rise. People loved John Paul, so they just went. They weren't real believers. They weren't real devotees. We saw the same thing in evangelicalism with the rise of the mega churches, you know, 30, 40,000 people. They weren't real believers. But what I'm running into now are doers of the word, not just hearers of the word. And that is encouraging, but it's also a sign that the end is near, because that's exactly what the Bible says, is a sign that the end is near. So we are seeing both. We're seeing the rise of the satanic, the rise of the wars and rumors of wars, but we're also seeing a rise of the devoted. And that, to me, is equally as big of a sign. But I want to talk about something I just mentioned, wars and rumors of wars. For a long time, that confused me. I'm like, rumors of war? Is that like Eric telling me, you know, hey, I heard there might be a war up in Canada? You know, like, what is a rumor of a war? But then I did some digging and found out what this actually means. When you translate it back to Aramaic and Greek and all that context, what does this mean? Well, rumor of war is actually, a better translation would be confusion of war, which is related to rumor, kind of like a telephone game, right? But what that means, and think about this, right now, we are fighting against Russia in Syria. We're fighting with Russia in Iraq. Right now, we are fighting against Iran in Iraq, but we are fighting with Iran in Libya. Right now, we are fighting against the Al-Qaeda elements in Iraq, but we're fighting with them in Egypt. So there's confusion. Literally, if there's an Al-Qaeda guy 50 feet to the east, you don't shoot him. If he's 50 feet to the west, you shoot him. Well, that's confusion of war. Nobody knows who they're really fighting, and nobody knows who they're fighting with or for. So we are living in this time where we are seeing wars and confusion, aka rumors, of war. Unlike any other time in history. Any other time in history, there's always a clear line, almost to their folly. You know, when you watch movies like The Patriot or whatever, you're like, who on earth lines up 50 people over here, lines up 50 people over there, and then they, like, say, ready, set, go, and they just start pummeling each other. But throughout human history, there's always these defined, you're for me, and I'm for you, and this is why I'm fighting. And right now, we are seeing for the first time this confusion of war. Who are we really fighting? Who's our allies? Who are we opposed to? And it changes by the day.
Yeah, it's an interesting point, too, and I think I brought up on your show too, you know, the Illuminati works by that. Out of disorder and chaos will come order. And, yep, you know, that's what they want. The New World Order wants revolution, so it doesn't surprise me that, you know, there are these liberals raising up against Trump. And that's happening all across America. When I do my Distress of Nations little blog, it's all across the world that people are missing this. It's not just in America where we're just, you know, we're so secluded and we don't pay attention to anyone else. It's happening all over the world, ladies and gentlemen. My question for you, Josh, is can America avert God's justice? There will be many who argue that essentially America is Babylon too, in a very loose sense. You know, we support sodomy, you know, pornography's here. Obviously, abortion is still here. I mean, is it possible for us to escape what truly should be owed to us at this point?
I don't know. I really don't know, and I know that's not an optimistic message, but I really don't know because we continue down this path. I mean, even if you like Trump, it's not as if he's ushering in righteousness. It's not as if he's saying, okay, we need to return to God's ways and God's laws or something. No. The only time God withholds his judgment is when people return to him. He says, seek my face. Pursue my ways. Seek ye first the kingdom of God, and all these things will be added unto you. But if you sin, he says in the Bible that he won't even hear our prayers, that he will hide his face from us. So in reality, we have to ask ourselves, are we turning to God? And when a country doesn't, then individuals have to. Because now it comes down to, man, whose team am I really on? Are we going to say, okay, well, you know, the rule says that I can't pray, so I'm not going to? Or are we going to be like Daniel and say, no, I'm praying anyway? So I think what we need to say is, instead of can America survive the justice that is coming, I would say, how do believers find other fellow believers, form tribes again, and live in a tribal nation of God, in a sense, inside of this nation? You know, because if we look at the Hebrews in the Bible, if we look at Israel in the Bible, they were still Israel inside Roman captivity. They were still Israel inside Egyptian captivity. Well, we need to become that again. God's people need to say, okay, we're not going to participate in the system. We're going to create our own system, and we're going to live by it. And if we do that, I think there's a chance for us. And I also think that that's what God uses to get people to believe. Remember, justice and persecution and punishment is not just because he wants to kill some people. It's so other people are moved to believe. And if we keep looking for an escape route as opposed to a conversion route, then the pressures keep coming. I mean, he's not going to stop.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, Josh. I know we have, you know, a different ideological structure in terms of theology, but that's actually what the Blessed Virgin Mary said to this one mystic, Blessed Anne Emmerich, where she talked about in these end times there would be like mini fortresses. Like it would be little towns that would be preserved, not necessarily whole nations. She talked about these places would be protected and preserved away from wars, disasters, and persecution. So that's very, very interesting because we kind of say it in similar terms in that sense. And wow, what a talk here. It's hard to imagine that we just passed an hour. I definitely.
Whoa.
It's past an hour already, Josh. And wow, yeah, great talk. I definitely look forward to hopefully getting back on your show. We'll definitely do this again. I want to give you the last few minutes to give us, do some shameless self-promotion, I call it. Get out, you know, upcoming projects, articles, media appearances. Let people know where they can buy the book. I'll give you the last few minutes here.
Well, thank you. First, I want to say thank you so much for having me on, and I can't wait to do it again on both sides. Your show, my show, it's just a great pairing. But people can find me at joshtully.com. I air on the GCN radio network, so if they're familiar with shows like Alex Jones, InfoWars, I air right after Alex. We actually share the same soundboard. So right after Alex, that's my show. I'm on 9 to 11. Actually, right before Alex. I'm on from 9 to 11 Central Standard. The book, Evangelpreneur, definitely get a copy and buy some for your friends and neighbors. We are selling this book by the case because so many people are reading this thing saying, oh my goodness. I mean, the subtitle itself, How Biblical Teachings on Free Enterprise Empower Faith, Family, and Freedom. So definitely get a copy of that. Also, we are putting together something called Purple Monkey University. My consulting company is Purple Monkey Garage. I love helping businesses. But a lot of people can't either A, afford to have me come in, or B, afford to travel to a seminar or something. But so we've just launched Purple Monkey University, which is 52 weeks. We give you a lesson every week, an assignment every week, real-world examples every week. And it actually takes you through my course, which I've been teaching to business owners all across the world. So it's definitely something to check out. Extremely affordable. It's only $12.50 a lesson. So it's cheaper than going to a movie. So definitely check that out. And I guess just keep on keeping on when it comes to looking for ways to advance your faith and your freedom and your family. I mean, we need to realize we need to start at home again. They've convinced us that we have to fix the world in order to fix our life, and the reality is our life is what we fix in order to change the world.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I write about this often. You know, we need to look at ourselves first, self-examine ourselves, look how we can better ourselves. You know, and all this, everything that we talked about today, folks, I know Josh would say this too, we're truly not trying to fearmonger. I mean, we just kind of relay the news. You know, it's realism, but I always preach, you know, keep your wings spread as an eagle in faith and hope. You know, the eagle is the only bird that once a great storm arrives, it doesn't flee to the mountains, as Scripture said. It doesn't fly like a sparrow to the mountain. It takes the storm head on. It loves the storm. When it feels that wind coming, it uses that wind, a.k.a. the cross, our trials, our tribulation, to rise above the storm. And that's what essentially is going to happen. I believe we can all see a great storm on the horizon, and that's the times we're living in. So it's faith and hope that we have to cling by, not, you know, falling into the den of despair, doubt, worry, you know, dragging your feet, you know, leaving Christianity altogether, as Josh talked about. But, you know, these are the times we live in, and some of the saints in the Catholic Church relished, like Saint Therese. She said, "I wish I could live during the period of the end times and the time of the Antichrist, who may very well appear." I know when I do some shows here in the future, I'm going to talk about Maitreya a little bit more, but you know, right after this economic collapse, his emergence is imminent. So we may very well be approaching, you know, the worst of the worst, if you will. So, Josh, I appreciate it. Yeah, look forward to getting on your show. We'll get you back on here the next few months. And, yes, ladies and gentlemen, please subscribe to Trad Cat Night. Make sure you subscribe to Josh's channel over there on YouTube as well. And until next time, stay safe and God bless.